Okay, so the second part of this lecture, I'll be looking at communication and culture, global gaming, and local contexts. So the first part was looking exclusively at my fieldwork in Korea. And for this lecture, I'll discuss how I extended the same approach and applied a cultural lens to the international context in gaming. So, in general, looking at popular culture and gaming as popular culture, it's not just junk culture. The way people use technologies, their meaning in people's lives, is a site of rich and diverse cultural practices that are worthy of investigation. And there are commercial relationships, so business at stake, style and identity is represented, as you saw with the Korean case especially. Youth and cultural practices are evident and must be teased out in every context, as well as one can get an idea of the social tensions and anxieties that exist in a given context, according to what people get paranoid about, what they regard as social ills. You can tell with how they regard gaming. Especially the interesting question has been when I ask people, "Are you a gamer?" And some people say yes right away. Other people have to think for a while. As I began this lecture, I freely describe myself as a gamer, but that's not always the case, I realize, because of certain taboos that may exist with identifying yourself as a gamer. You might be regarded as frivolous or geeky or marginal. Sometimes there are barriers to entry in some circles. How do you qualify as a gamer? Do you play serious enough games? Do you play first-person shooters? Or are you just a girl who plays puzzle games? And sometimes it's those girls who play puzzle games that don't call themselves gamers, even though they are. Worse yet, are you a game addict? And all these different social constructions start to come into play, whether you're regarded as antisocial, all the stereotypes, you'll forego eating, sleeping, bathing, drinking in favor of gaming in your mother's basement. I actually did game in a basement. There's nothing wrong with it. And so, how are digital games different from something like golf, or basketball, or tennis, or dodgeball, or football, in the European sense, in the American sense? In our everyday social lives, these are hobbies. These are things that people go crazy over. People die at soccer games all the time, but you don't see the government kind of trying to intervene and say, "Oh, maybe we shouldn't," or "maybe we should take this away or regulate it. There would be even more riots in the streets," right? So looking at gaming, video gaming in particular, as another social outlet or hobby, is the same approach I choose to take. And in the Korean context, it showed that this was the case where people were using that cultural industry to form social bonds and to work, to meet with friends, and to just be youth in Korea. So, in this global study, I was again questioning the assumptions that even researchers make about the environments where games are played. And so the objective here was to again look at the culture, social structure, and infrastructure of how people use virtual worlds specifically, or in the places where they don't. And that is especially in Lightning. So if I went into a specific cultural environment and I just assumed that people played games, I would be out of luck in many cases in this research, because this is why it's good to go in person. And in an age of the internet and Skype, there's still reason to physically go to these sites of inquiry to experience the embodiment, to eat, sleep, and breathe the environment you're in, because you're not just looking at games. You're looking at the whole communication ecology. And communication is eating, sleeping, breathing, how we do these everyday things differently around the world. I'm describing this global study that I did as an ethnographer, employing this strategy in 6 countries in 7 weeks. It was a collaborative study, and the white paper can be found online. It's by myself, Suzanne de Castel, and Nick Taylor. It can be found on my blog, describing the nature of the study details. But basically, I chose Japan, Korea, Singapore, India, the United Arab Emirates, and Mexico as these sites where I would look at how people play in public. And I was in charge with deploying an online survey that was made by others on the team, as well as conduct a qualitative study where I employed an ethnographic sensibility to the lived environments of these gamers and how they gamed. I didn't know what would happen. And so this was the mystery. How did cultural context interact with the online games that I was setting forth to investigate? This is a picture from just normal traffic in Bangalore, India. And that's a picture of World of Warcraft in an internet cafe in India. Researching how people engaged in virtual worlds, in offline contexts, was especially fascinating. At times, it was really boring. I watched a lot of people meet online, wait around, and die. And this happened all the time, just hours and hours looking at people playing and mostly dying. And this is the nature of MMORPGs. This is why it takes so long. People, they log on for 8 hours at a time. They're not necessarily engaged in active play. They might be doing something else. They could tab out and do some online dating or something in a different window. Or they could be having a meal on the side. They could be off at a friend's station and chatting with them while they're kind of waiting for something to crank away. So these are just the practices surrounding online games. Mexico was a stay where it was my first one besides Korea of this nature. So that was enlightening, because the infrastructure in Mexico was substantially more limited, as you may imagine. There were people who engaged in virtual world activities such as Second Life or World of Warcraft. That was ultimately what I had to go find. And that was the major restriction. I couldn't just find any world, but I had to see what worlds they used. So most of the internet cafes looked like this. And they didn't have virtual worlds. It was mostly simple games or basic communication abilities, web surfing, but not virtual worlds like World of Warcraft or Second Life, because those were more demanding in terms of infrastructure. And if you're in Mexico, I can understand why you wouldn't want to be in an internet cafe. You're in Mexico, and the weather's warm, and you can do other things outside, mostly. So in the Korean case, that's a contrast. I talked about that in the previous lecture. But the population density is amazingly dense. Seoul itself is a city of approximately 12 million people. And to myself, I don't have much space in the everyday. And people are forced into these tiny spaces where the assigned behavior is a certain thing. But PC bungs were more of a flexible space, right? So, okay, you have a PC, but it's quite non-prescriptive for what you might do. So, again, online dating was a popular activity. Chatting, gambling online, betting, making bets, trading items, and playing games was also an activity. In Singapore, that was really... this was the best internet cafe I went to, where they had what I was looking for, the virtual worlds. And so it wasn't the nicest cafe. It was really dingy, because in order to do virtual worlds, you needed a membership. And this one was full of regulars, so they knew each other. They trusted the environment they were in. Other places were nicer, but they didn't have as much trust in that specific environment, so they didn't play virtual worlds. So this was an interesting contrast. So virtual worlds in public places, because of the hacking paranoia, they wanted to go to specifically trusted sites, as opposed to more comfortable, more expensive, nicer sites. This was just a selfie. This was at 3 a.m. after watching group after group die. And they also took my survey. So this is just to show some of the environment that is in Singapore. It's a very multicultural nation, city, and this is just Little India, where the internet cafes there are not virtual world oriented. I was looking for them, but I couldn't find them. Mostly they were productivity software oriented. So getting visas photocopied, and migrant workers trying to go on Skype, or doing word processing, basic cafes with those kind of services, not virtual worlds. Contrasting with that, this was one of the nicer cafes I was talking about. It's not even like a cafe. It's more like a club. there are like three screens, club music, like subwoofers, and you felt like you should be dressed up in a club, but they had all these machines where people were playing things like Call of Duty, and just you know, not virtual worlds. So I didn't get much of the data I was after. See, this is the difference between being after a specific kind of data, as opposed to letting the data come to you, deductive versus inductive. But nonetheless, I was able to record what was actually happening at cafes such as these. And it was a premium, luxurious experience, and as opposed to like this one. But this one was where I had struck virtual world gold. So that was the contrast, right? There are also different little cafes. This was just a board game cafe where, you know, people from work would meet up. You could order a smoothie and also have a selection of board games to take and play at your table or not. And the interesting thing about Singapore is that they have citywide Wi-Fi. So you just need to have a Singaporean address and you can be connected because it's small and you can, that infrastructure accommodates you. Now back to that dingy cafe with everything I wanted. So the regulars at this cafe, felt really comfortable and they trusted the environment. This guy was sleeping there when I arrived. He was also sleeping there when I left. And it was that kind of environment. On to India. India was more challenging pretty much because of infrastructural issues. There'd be numerous power cuts. This had to affect my own rhythm as well in dealing with the issues. Keep in mind, I was charged with deploying an online survey. And online surveys assume that you have power and steady internet access. And so going to India was necessarily that much more challenging. And it showed me that I needed to find ways to work around those issues. When I arrived at this cafe, this was after asking around. Finally, there was a cafe that had virtual worlds available. When I got there, it was dark. And they said, well, power's been out since 1 p.m. But they were still playing because they had generators going. And so the place of play was really so important that even the fans weren't going. There were no lights, but there was still World of Warcraft. And so the way I conducted the survey there was a Word document. So it wasn't an online fill in, then hit next. It was the offline Word document, giving it to participants and saying, okay, can you help by filling out this version? And then we would enter it in after the fact. So on a large scale, that's way more difficult to do, of course, but that's how you accommodate this type of context. This is just more of the cafe. They're playing, they typically like playing Dota, and I would find lots of Dota in these cafes. And what was really interesting was this was the very beginning of the Facebook craze in India. However, the motivations for logging onto Facebook were not necessarily friends. I asked some informants, well, why are you logging onto Facebook? Well, they wanted to play Farmville. So Farmville, being a social network game, was interesting enough to log on to Facebook. And so this was just at the beginning of that. And I thought, I'll make note of that for later. And then on to the Middle East. This was Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. So going from low-cost kind of power outages to Dubai was a big contrast. This is one of the types of cafes I encountered. Not every cafe was created equal. Similar to Singapore, there were some that were made for just basic communication. But it was all in the same cafe. You would have segregated sections of the cafes where the lounge area might look like this. And this was another cafe where this was mostly Emirati males who were playing in this section. And it was a multifaceted section where they could do any kind of software. So this was different from other cafes where, you know, the context of Dubai especially is that it's only 20% Emirati. 80% are foreigners who come to work in various industries, whether it be to be university teachers or to be servers at restaurants. It really is a market for imported labor. So the Emiratis here are playing World of Warcraft and generally using their own money to buy WoW gold, the virtual currency, and buying dragons and all sorts of all sorts of things that you can buy with gold in WoW. And it was almost a completely different game from what I was used to thinking of it as, with all this gold on hand that you could suddenly use. And in Dubai, of course, there's the real stark public, private, male, female dichotomy. So this is just on a bus where in the front you'd have ladies and families only section, and the rest were the rest. So that was an explicit account of gender segregation. And so, you know, you can't help but see this kind of thing in the everyday. You saw earlier there were the Emirati males in white and the Emirati females who are still playing, but amongst themselves in black up there. So let's see. We can point right here. And so it's, you know, these women were just in this amusement park. And actually, the difference here was this was a Filipina worker at this amusement center, and she was dressed kind of like me. And I realized that because I look the way I look, I didn't have to conform to these rules. But if I looked like this, there were different assumptions about me, for better or for worse, right? I could actually access the Emirati males. I went to this cafe, and I went right up to them and talked, and they welcomed me and were very courteous. I can't say the same would happen if I was an Emirati female, right? So these are kind of the cultural aspects. What was also interesting was I managed to talk to Emirati females who do play games, but they play from home, right? They're not playing in the cafes. And actually, some were quite serious about games. One was into this One Piece Luffy game and used money to buy about $100 worth of in-game gold in a year. So it's not inconsequential. It's rather, the serious play can happen in public and private places. And so your idea of who is a gamer might be misrepresented if you're not digging far enough. Being in game worlds also helped people communicate, right? Because games are a medium of communication. So between the sexes, you might imagine more subversive communication happening. Young people draw on the products of consumer industries and the mass media, not to resist dominant culture, but to forge a meaningful sense of self in a world increasingly characterized by instability and risk. This is from the book Youth Media by Oz Gerby. So the local place, people, local traditions is again recognized as significant to young people's identity. In Tokyo, Japan, this was really different from South Korea in the way games kind of rose as an activity. A lot because of the platform differences. So PC gaming is really popular in Korea. Console gaming is popular in Japan. And also mobiles were way more popular. Broadband took off in Korea at a different start time and rate than in Japan. So all these other historical factors lay the groundwork for what happened in Japan. There aren't as many PC bungs. This was the one I found after asking around and going to all these other, manga cafes where you can look at comic books. You can even have a lie flat bed to sleep. In the situation of Tokyo, the local city population increases by approximately 3 million during the work week because you have all these people coming in from the surrounding cities to Tokyo to work, but they're not necessarily going home at the end of the day. They might be doing other things within the city, including going to these cafes and sleeping in very closed off capsule kind of cubby holes. But this was an open style cafe where you'd have the benches set up. That's very different from the other places I was observing. It's supposed to be more female friendly, but there were no females. It was just me. They give free ice cream. This started me on this theme of publicly acquired games and privately consumed. In Japan, it seemed that it wasn't like the other places I looked at where games were really an excuse to be social. This was kind of an outlying case where in Akihabara, there were these people with their devices and they weren't saying a word to one another. It was just walking up, getting a map, walking away. Walking up to another person, getting a map, and then going away. So this was a consumption practice I had not seen in the other sites. But they were supposedly getting maps for their own use to play the game, but they weren't talking at all with one another. It was a way to touch, but not to physically touch. So I wonder what the terms are of participation in these public and private spaces in a digital age. So what counts as participation? And I'm wondering this about the Finnish context as well, but we can talk about that more. In terms of public and private, I just thought it was funny. Are any of you familiar with durians? Durians. So they're this really spiky fruit, and the smell from durians can be quite objectionable. And in Singapore, they're numerous, so they're really forbidden in many hotels and public spaces. So, but durians, to people who like the taste, are wonderful, and they take them and clandestinely eat them, and it's like this lovely private consumption of this stinky fruit. But it's along with all the other forbidden behaviors and finds, which I thought were interesting and kind of a metaphor for how some people game. along the lines of gender. Again, this is in the subway in Japan, and it says women only during these hours. So during rush hour, when people are cramming themselves into the subway trains, there's a danger of being groped and just other kind of objectionable things. So there's a car that is devoted to just women during rush hour. And so that was pretty similar to that gender explicit situation on public transit in Dubai. As I mentioned, in Japan, the objective was to remain anonymous or antisocial when logging on to these virtual worlds. And my informants there told me that as soon as they formed strong bonds with the people they were playing with, it was time to leave, rather than playing with the objective of fostering sociality. And that was an interesting contrast. So in this case, games as a medium of communication meant something different in the Japanese context as opposed to the other countries I investigated. It was definitely the outlier. And interesting in its own way, but this was just a really, really super lightning quick sampling of all these places that I could have just stayed and done an in-depth contextual study of, like in Korea. So the point is to enable one's audience to understand something of interest about a corner of the world they haven't experienced directly themselves. And this ethnography has a real role to play in the design of games and also even understanding the role of communication technologies in our lives. It's a hard task. I mean, I think that some of you in this room have done your own field work, and you can attest that this is a fully involved, embodied effort. We do research. It doesn't just happen. It's exhausting physically and mentally. But the result is serious engagement with discovering what we can know about how life is lived in another social and cultural setting. And that will continue to be immensely valuable for understanding how we communicate in the world. And if you have any questions, please feel free to contact me. Right now, I'm wondering what the next 10 years will bring. I'm looking at social games, mobile platforms, and I'm here in Finland looking at these issues between Europe and Asia. Next month, I will be returning to South Korea to do some more investigation as well. But with that, I close my lecture and thank you for your attention.